Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.
Hello and welcome to Straight Down the Middle, the golf show here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Tom Reed, who is senior teaching professional at Stoke Park Golf and Country Club, and Jeremy Dale, who's a PGA coach and a switch hitting trick shot artist. Gents, a wonderful Travelers Championship, and Ches Reavy managed to hold on for the win.
Yeah, Ches Reavy, I mean, you know, he's had an up and down career. Longest gap between first and second professional win. He got his tour card in 2007, won the Canadian Open, which was a massive event at the time, in 2008, and then he had a serious wrist injury. He then went 250 tournaments, which is nearly 4,000 days, until his next win, which was last night at the Travelers, with home favourite Keegan Bradley chasing him down. So he's had a fantastic victory there. And also, you know, this isn't a surprise. He's been trending in the right direction. Great finish at the US Open at Pebble Beach gave him some confidence. And I think it's a story of perseverance there. You know, this is a guy that's obviously became a great player very quickly in his early 20s. Had a huge gap with injury and then loss of form, and then comes back to win one of the biggest tournaments on the schedule with a great finish in the US Open as well. So I think that hopefully for Ches, this is a sign of more good things to come.
It just also shows how difficult it is to actually win a golf tournament and finish it off. I mean, golf is one of the only games, really, where you have to actually finish the course rather than wait for the final whistle. And this was a really interesting one because he had a massive lead going into the last round. He kept it for nine holes, and then Keegan Bradley made four birdies in the first six holes of the back nine. And by the 17th, it was down to one. And Reavy plucked up the courage and hit it just over the water and made his putt for a birdie whilst Keegan Bradley was making a bit of a horlicks of it and made a double. So then the scores at the end looked quite a lot further apart than the tournament actually was. But it was a bit like the PGA at Bethpage Black, where it looked like it was going to be a stroll in the park, and then suddenly it wasn't. And it just shows it is a really, really difficult thing to actually finish these tournaments off.
Why was there such a long gap between that first win and the second one for Reavy?
It seemed it was injury caused. You know, 2008, first, you know, within a year of getting his tour card, he suffers a really bad wrist injury. And the surgery that he underwent, the surgeon said to him, "We're not actually too sure if this is going to work." And he had
always good. That's always what good. You want to hear from your surgeon.
At the start of your career on tour, having picked up that win, and then the surgeon saying, you know, you might not be able to play again. So he had months and months in the doldrums of just not knowing whether he was going to be back out playing again. And obviously things worked out well for him, but like you say, 250 tournaments later and he picks up a win. Yeah, that's a big gap between victories. So like I say, you know, obviously he was a great player, but amazing perseverance to come through and get himself back up to the top of the game.
People think that the course of professional golf always runs smooth, and we did talk about this on a previous show when we were referring to Graham McDowell, who'd won the US Open and then had struggled a lot and eventually came back and had a great performance at Pebble Beach this year. And you saw it with Danny Willett as well, wins the Masters, then he's suddenly 500 in the world and then back to winning in Dubai. And it doesn't actually work as people think. You can't just hold on to your game. It comes and goes. These guys, they don't always own their game. They just borrow it for a bit and then they have to hand it back, as seemingly.
How often do people manage to go from the top to really struggling to back to the top again? We've seen, of course, Tiger Woods do it in quite some style recently. How frequent are those kind of stories?
I think they're really frequent, and sometimes they don't come back. I mean, you get stories like Sandy Lyle and Ian Baker Finch and Seve to a certain extent. I mean, these are guys who are major champions and legends in the game. And then suddenly they can't do it anymore. And Ian Baker Finch is, if you Google him, he'll come up as the Open champion at Royal Birkdale. But he'll also come up as a guy who missed the first fairway at St Andrews. And it's over 100 yards wide and he missed it on the left. And he got to a point where Yeah, he couldn't really play tournament golf anymore. And he's a wonderful player. And I've met him a few times and watched him hit balls. And you'd go, well, there's a swing that can't possibly go wrong. But somehow it does. It's a funny old game.
A funny old game.
And there's three guys as well that interestingly played in the tournament. You've got Martin Kaymer, who was world number one, plummeting outside of the top 200, now showing a bit of form again. He was leading after two rounds. Unfortunately, he had a terrible third round with 75, which blew him out of the tournament. But he still finished up there, you know, with a decent finish and tied for 16th. But then you've got guys like Eduardo Molinari, who was a top 50 player in the world, brother of Francesco, who's doing rather well at the moment, finishing third. He's coming back out of the doldrums. Kyrgios, same sort of player, five-time winner on the tour, lost a lot of form. He finished third this week as well. But I think the best mention for this event was Lee Westwood. He had his 165th top 10 finish. Which is it's a phenomenal career.
I'd like to be his caddy.
Billy Foster did well out of Lee Westwood, amongst others. But, you know, Westwood was a guy that went from world number one outside the top 300 in the world. And, you know, he fought his way back. So there's a lot of mental resilience in some of these guys.
I think also anybody who's picked up a golf club will understand in their own game how transient form is. I mean, people complain when they start the game that they can't. They're amazed at the differences. Sometimes they top the ball 10 yards, and other times they hit it 200 yards. Other times it goes 50 yards left, other times it goes to the right, and they can't really understand it. And, of course, they're not very skilled, but the misses in golf can be huge. And the pros are obviously much better, but they have exactly the same problems as anybody who's picked up a club. And that comes as something of a surprise to the inexperienced golfer. It is just the same. Everybody's kind of doing, I think, the same thing. It's just their level is so much better. But the game is no different at amateur level. It's just massively inconsistent. But the thing that surprises me is that the handicap golfer doesn't really see why the pros should have the same experiences as them. But for them, the game is exactly the same.
Mm. It's a game of fine margins to such an extent that even something that you might think of as a relatively small thing, such as the crowd, can play a really significant role. Of course, Reavy won despite the supporters rather than because of them, shall we say.
Well, Keegan Bradley is from New England, and it's well known that he's a Boston Red Sox fan, and this tournament was played in Connecticut at TPC River Highlands, and obviously most of the crowd were from that area, and obviously most of them wanted Bradley to win. And when he started making a charge, the crowd do what American crowds seem to always do these days, and that is they cheer for their man, and they show incredible lack of respect to the opponent. And that's okay in a football game, but it's not okay in golf. And they
do you think it's unsporting, Jeremy?
I just think it's rubbish behaviour, because it's just not what you do, and it's a different kind of game. You rely on concentration. The player has to initiate the action in golf, and that's one of the mental difficulties of it. It's a bit like a penalty kick in rugby.
It's never reactive.
What happens in a penalty kick in rugby? It doesn't matter if it's Australia, New Zealand, or England, Wales, or whoever. The crowd goes silent, apart from one or two whistles, perhaps. But that's kind of frowned on, and golf is the same. And you need to concentrate. And if you get distracted in the middle of your backswing, then that could potentially end in disaster. And as we know, you know, these tournaments are won and lost on a single shot.
Yeah, and I think the players do have a certain element of control. You know, if the crowd are particularly raucous and say things that are over the line, the players can go ahead and point out those individuals and have them removed from the tournament.
Can they do it even if they just don't like their shoes?
Potentially. I mean, Gary Woodland, I mean, he got lucky there, didn't he? He was very quiet on the 18th tee.
I think you should try that next time, John.
No, but I mean, there's been some victims of that, and I think Colin Montgomery's taken a fair bit of abuse from the American crowds. Rory certainly took a fair bit over the years as well. And I think, you know, Bethpage Black was an interesting example. You know, the New York crowds are well known for being a little outspoken. And my favourite response to crowd heckling was Brooks Koepka's at the PGA. The crowd were actually chanting choke at him as he came down the stretch on the last five holes. And the commentator asked him in the post-round interview, you know, did that put you off, Brooks? And he said, not really, because they were right, I was choking. It gave him the reminder he needed to finish the tournament off. So I think, you know, there's limits to it. I think it can be upsetting to some players, but it all comes down to how they take it and how they use it for the rest of their rounds.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. They will have to find a way of dealing with it. And also it helps that they kind of expect it. I mean, Reavy himself said, I knew that was going to happen. So they must see this a lot. some locations probably more than others, but they must have a way of preparing for it. You know, you could mentally train yourself to expect that. And Tiger actually had the same kind of training. His father would play a game with him where he could do anything in his backswing and in his preparations. He could throw things at him. And
it's one of those games where I equate a game
like
with fun. Yeah. And you think, my dad throwing a spanner at me while I try and concentrate. Obviously, it probably wasn't spanners. But not my idea of fun, Jeremy.
Well, not mine either. But but then if you're trying to be the greatest player that ever lived, and that's as much your father's wish as yours, which I think is the case with Tiger, then these kinds of things are helpful, useful training. So call it distraction training, call it what you like. It obviously worked for Tiger, and I'm sure that all the players do that when they're competing in these events. They have to find a way of just shrugging it off and going, oh, idiots, or I'll show them, or whatever that is.
And it comes back down to you know, that ability to be resilient. And I think that any sportsman, especially in an individual sport, they have to be resilient, because golf is a hugely psychological game. And for guys like Cameron Westwood, who reach world number one, there's only one place to go from there. You know, the next thing for them is to win more majors and more tournaments. It's that never-ending cycle of trying to do more, more, more. And I think sometimes you can push a little harder than you need to, and that's what pushes you outside of the realms of top 50 in the world, which is where the contracts get bigger, the prize money gets bigger, and there's a lot of pressure on these players once they get there to actually maintain that standard and stay there.
We saw wonderful play of that sort at the BMW Open. It was a big win for Pavan.
Yeah, I mean, the 30-year-old, he's had 7 wins professionally, but he's had a really up and down professional career. Again, very resilient. 2010 is when he turned pro. He's 21. He got his tour card in 2012, and he only made 8 cuts all season, which means he lost his European tour card. And then what happens then is you go back down to Tier 2, which is the Challenge Tour. He won the Order of Merit, which means he won the season standings, and he got back on the European Tour at 2014. Guess what? He lost his tour card again. Back to the qualifying school, and no good. So he spends 2015, 16 and 17 back on the Challenge Tour. And obviously these are 4-round tournaments, travelling all over Europe and all over the world, in fact, where he's still working hard in his game and still trying to get his status back on the tour. He then does very well on the Challenge Tour Order of Merit 2017. He's back on tour in 2018 and picks up his maiden win and finishes 34th on the Race to Dubai list. And then again picked up a massive win on Sunday, fighting off Matthew Fitzpatrick in a playoff, who's a very dogged player, especially down the last 5 holes. So, you know, he's obviously come from a good pedigree. He's had a fantastic sort of growth into the European Tour. He's experienced failure, and he seems to have risen above it. So now that he's got 2 wins, sits inside the top 20 of the Order of Merit now, I think he's going to be a good player in the future, and maybe even a Ryder Cup pick for next year.
Ooh, it's a big tip.
Yeah, I would expect that particularly. I certainly would expect that of Matt Fitzpatrick. And I think Matt will be kicking himself actually a little bit. He had the lead and he drove the ball onto a par 4, the 16th. And then 3-putted it, bogeyed the 17th and had to birdie the 18th to get into the playoff. I think Matt is going to be really annoyed with how he didn't actually finish that tournament off. But again, like we just were talking about with Ches Reavie, it is really hard. I mean, these guys aren't machines. Things do happen. But that was most uncharacteristic for Fitzpatrick. I do think that Pavan finished it nicely, though. He made a birdie on the 18th in normal time. In the playoff, the second time of asking, he made a birdie on the 18th as well. So hats off to him. But I really think Matt Fitzpatrick let one go there.
And when you're trying to do something as psychologically difficult as holding on at the end of a long tournament, then every little helps. And with that in mind, coming up, we'll be asking, how important is the role of the caddy?
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to Straight Down the Middle here on Love Sport Radio with me, Johnny Burrow, and Tom Reed and Jeremy Dale. Of course, both golfing experts. But gents, to the untrained eye, the role of a caddy looks like an easy one. You wander round a very, very nicely maintained grass field holding someone else's golf clubs, and you get a big check at the end of it. Am I being unfair?
I think all of the caddies on both the PGA and European Tour would be very upset with that statement, Johnny. No. I think it is a hugely important role. You know, they act as friends as well as advisors. You know, that they know how to, well, if they're good, they know how to pick you up when you're down, and they know when to say the right thing and equally when not to say the wrong thing. Because these players are playing for a lot of money, under a lot of pressure, week on week. And sometimes the margins to winning, the margins to success are so fine. And just a little comment from a caddy can make or break the player's performance. So obviously there's some more famous caddies who've had huge amounts of success and definitely have picked up some of the greatest players in the world. But caddies do their work now. You know, they have wind charts, they walk the golf courses, they pay a lot of attention to the finer detail, and they do a lot of work on the golf course prior to the player actually seeing it. These caddies have seen the golf course, they've walked it, they've paced out where the flag positions are likely to be, and they've picked up some local knowledge on how the course is going to play this week. And that's before the player even arrives on the first tee for their first practice round. So these guys, you know, it's a high paid job at the top end, 10% of wins along with their weekly wage and expenses. So these caddies want their 10%.
Do you know anyone who's looking for a new caddy? I'm asking for a mate.
Neither of us, lad.
Oh,
you won't make much money on us, Johnny.
Yeah, I do think it's a really important job in the sense that it can go either way. With a bad caddy can be an absolute pain, and a good caddy can help you make up your mind on every shot. Now, if you want, one of the big things I think in golf is you have to have an intention with each shot, and you have to try and fit the shot to the problem that you face on the course. And decisiveness is massive. The tiny seed of doubt can cause a bad swing. And for handicapped golfers listening, very often after a bad shot, handicapped golfers look in completely the wrong place for the reason of their bad shot. They tend to look at their swing, when actually very often all it was is they're standing over the ball thinking, well, I've got a 6-iron, but I think it's really a 5. And that can be enough to put them off, make them make a bad swing, or if they haven't got enough club, they hit the ball harder, and then they blame their swing, and they're looking completely the wrong place. You have to be decisive, and one of the big differences, I read a book, great book by Ken Venturi, who was a commentator and a US Open champion, and he said the order of thoughts very often for a golfer, for an inexperienced golfer, and for a golfer playing badly is not good. What they do is they look at the target, and then they look at the trouble, and then they go, I'd like to go at the target, but I'm a bit worried about the trouble. A good golfer, or one that's thinking properly, will do the opposite. He'll go, right, there's the trouble. I mean, Nicholas used to say every single time to Angelo, his caddy, where's the trouble? And he would be quite conservative in his play for the first two rounds of a major championship because he didn't want to make a big mistake. And what they do is they look, right, where's the trouble? And then where's the target? And the target might not be the hole. So, for example, on a hole where there's water in front, I always get people to take a yardage to the back edge of the green. So if the green's 30 yards long and they're trying to hit to the back edge of the green, they can have a 30-yard miss hit and still carry the water. Now, a caddy can help make up the player's mind so that he is decisive at the moment of truth. And then you don't get that, oh, I think it's a 5, but maybe it's a 6, or maybe I should be hitting a fade here instead of a draw, or and what am I trying to do?
What happens if you don't trust your caddy?
Well, you learn, well, that's why you practice rounds are for, and obviously you would employ somebody and develop a relationship with them. And I think these things sometimes do go badly wrong, and then you get a few missed clubs, and then you start to mistrust the caddy, as we saw last week with Jordan Spieth, whose caddy's been fantastic for ages, and suddenly he starts blaming him. So in truth, it's always the player that's responsible, but the caddy can really help them settle their mind before they hit a shot, I think.
You've done an exceptional job there, I have to say, of making me realise what a good caddy is. But what makes someone a really subpar caddy?
Well, not paying attention. I mean, I liken it to being a waiter. You've got to wait hand and foot on your player. And I've done this. My first job in golf was as a caddy at the Open Championship. We did a few pro-ams before for a fellow called John Garner, who's a Ryder Cup player in the 1970s. He played twice. And he had one last chance at the Open in 1984, which was won by Seve Ballesteros. And we actually qualified at Scotts Craig in Dundee with Manuel Ballesteros, who didn't get through, but my player did. So 4 days of the Open Championship, and he made the cut on the second day, and there was a cut in those days on the third day. And to make that cut, he had to make 5-4 on the road hole and then the last hole. and he was in the road hole bunker for three without any chance of going at the hole. Hit it out to 30 feet and hold the putt and then made a par at the last. So that got us into the last day. It was a fantastic memory. I had absolutely nothing to do with that as a caddy. But I know that he enjoyed having me on the bag, and there were certain things that I did say to him. I mean, we made a really ropey bogey. He made a five on a terrible five, really. He sort of chipped and putted for a five, and he said, "Oh, crikey, nearly made six there." I said, "But you didn't." And he went, "No, that's right, positive." And on we went. And
whereas if you'd gone, "Yeah, you're right, exactly. You're rubbish."
Exactly.
So what were you doing?
So a bad caddy, I mean, you can get a club. If you go to a club and you get somebody you don't know, then I have a really hard time, actually. I'd rather carry my own bag than have somebody that I don't know on around. But if you do know them, then you can train them and make sure that they don't make the mistakes that are going to annoy you. And you pretty soon get a fair idea, I think.
I think you've made a good point there, Jeremy. You have to train the caddy sometimes. And it's a personality match as much as anything else, because tour players will pick up caddies who have tour experience. So they'll get the job based on the fact that these guys have been out there and they know the game. But it takes time to get to know each other. And that personality match is just as important as the skill of the caddy itself. And as Jeremy said, saying the right thing at the right time, making a positive statement during a stressful part of the round, those are the sorts of things that keep the players moving in the right direction. But it's definitely a big pressure job.
And you saw that actually with Gareth Lord and Justin Rose at the Memorial. You saw them laughing all the time, and they'd just been thrown together. And you could see that they were both enjoying it, and that showed in Justin's level of play, both in that tournament and at the US Open. Even though his striking wasn't that good, you could see that there was a certain momentum to it, and that Gareth was playing a part in that. And he's caddied for some great players, Robert Carlson, for example, and I forget.
Henrik Stenson.
That's the one. Yes.
Absolutely.
That's it. Yes. Yes.
And I think, you know, another example of where a caddy came good was with Justin Rose. You know, when he picked up his maiden US Open, or his only major championship, he had a rough start to his round. And he had this tactic where he would draw a line down here, a particular section of holes that hadn't gone too well for him. And that was the line in the sand. That meant, we finished with those holes, we're going to move on to the next ones now. And his caddy at the time said to him, "All right, let's draw a line through those holes." So Justin picks out the scorecard from his pocket. He draws a line with his pencil. And psychologically, that means that's done. Now we're going to move forward. And he goes ahead and wins the major championship.
Best advice, if you're caddying for the first time for somebody, there are three golden rules. Turn up, keep up, and shut up. And then you can't go wrong.
I'm not very good at any of those things. And with that in mind, just to ground this conversation about how important caddies are in a practical context, you two know that I'm not a golfing expert on your level and that I like talking. With that in mind, how much would having me as your caddy negatively impact your performance?
It might not at all. And golf is a game.
I don't believe you.
Well, I said might. And that means that it might also be absolutely disastrous. But one of the things about golf is that there is significant time, downtime, I call it, between shots. You've got game time when you need to be all business. And then there's downtime when you're walking, to your drive, or you're waiting for your partners to play. And that's when actually coming out of the round can be quite useful. So a lot of players use that time to just chat with the caddies and make jokes, and you'd be quite useful for that, I'd have thought.
Oh, isn't that nice? I'm still not convinced. I think I'd be hopeless, but I'm interested by that role they can play, Jeremy, in terms of managing the emotion of the player, both when they're actually going for a putt and saying, "Listen, you didn't go for six," or just having a laugh. How much of their job is psychological? And how much of it is actually about the game itself?
I think it's hugely psychological. You know, the player is capable of doing their own yardages. And in most cases, the player will do a yardage, the caddy will do a yardage, then they'll compare notes. So I think that really the caddy's role is to remind the player of their process, which is, what's the yardage? Where's the trouble, as Jeremy said? Are we going to play to the back of the green or the front of the green? Where are you aiming? What is your intention with this shot? And these seem like such basic things, but these are the things that go out of the window when your mind is scrambled and you're under pressure during a golf tournament. And the caddy is there to remind you of your process. And I remember Louis Oosterhuizen, he was struggling with his golf back in 2009, 2010, and he said he couldn't concentrate for 5 hours. And he employed the help of a very famous golf psychologist in Carl Morris. And Carl Morris instructed him to get a red Sharpie, draw a circle on his white golf glove, and then use it as a concentration button. So Louis's job was to physically, okay,
oh, no.
push this button. No, this is serious, oh. all right? And when it was on, it was concentration time, it was game time. When it was off, him and his caddy would talk about anything else
other
than golf.
Sounds like he just watched 8 episodes of Super Nanny and then decided to become a caddy.
And then he won the British Open at St Andrews by 8 shots.
Fair enough.
And it worked.
Yeah, except we're going to call it the Open Championship, not the British Open. But I've got another story about nerves, actually, because the caddy can really help mental processes. And what you've got to remember is these guys are really nervous. Mm. When they're coming down the stretch. I once had the great pleasure to interview Tony Jacklin, who won the 1970 US Open, and he sat on a 4-shot lead overnight. And he said he was so nervous that in the morning he would have traded places, he said, with any form of life. And then, obviously, the round...
Including an amoeba.
Yes, I think so. That's exactly the gist of it. And he said, you've really got no idea how nervous you can get. And then... after it had finished and it had gone really well and he'd hold putt after putt and he'd won by 7, actually at Hazeltine National, which is the scene of the Ladies PGA Championship this weekend, which we'll cover later. But he said at the end of it, I'd won by 7, I wouldn't have traded places with any form of life. And it had all gone really well, but he was unbelievably nervous. And I think that's, as Tom said, that's when your process can get out of kilter, when you're so... emotional that you simply forget to do the things that got you there in the first place.
Mm. And obviously there's not just positive stories about caddies, there's also negatives, and I've dug up an absolute beauty here. Okay, the Golden Bear, I'll set the scene for you. Golden Bear, Jack Nicklaus, okay, at this point it's 1983. Okay, he's got 17 majors under his belt and he has been tasked with a very big job in caddying for his son Gary at the US Open qualifier in Florida. Okay, so off they go. Gary pars the first 3 holes. Get to the 4th hole and Gary wants to hit 4-iron. The problem he's got is that there's 2 4-irons in his bag. He's just played 3 holes of golf with 15 clubs in his golf bag, which is one too many. So his 14-year-old son, competing for the US Open Championship, receives a 6-shot penalty on account of, you could blame Dad, for not checking how many clubs he had in his bag before he teed off.
And it wasn't even the case that that extra club was a different club that would have given an advantage. It was just stupidity.
I think it was Dad's 4-iron in the bag.
Oh, and, Dad, that's a bad one.
More famously, that happened to Ian Woosnam, sadly, when they had the Open Championship at Lytham, won by David Duval in the late 90s, I think, or early 2000s. And, Woosie got to the second tee, having made a birdie on the first hole, right in the thick of it, and the caddy went, oh my goodness, I think you're going to explode. I've got 2 drivers in the bag. And they were trying out 2 drivers. Why Woosie was trying out 2 drivers on the driving range 5 minutes before the Open Championship, who knows? But the caddy didn't take them out. And that cost him a 2-shot penalty and all the momentum that he had. And he's a great confidence player. And, former Masters champion and never won another major, despite being number one in the world. He was, it's not the thing you ask him about, actually. And again, I've had the pleasure of interviewing him at corporate events. And I would never even dream of going there. But then I threw it open to the audience.
And they went.
First question. It was like, what about the 15 clubs, Woosie? And he went, why do you want to ask me about that? He said, I don't want to be remembered for that. I was number one in the world and I won the Masters. Talk about that. And he got quite annoyed.
That's
quite annoyed with it. And I don't blame him in a way, because it's a terrible thing and a real jolt to... you know, everything that you've been working for, so the caddy can obviously mess it up completely.
I've got a final question for you on the caddy front, which is, as I understand it, most of these guys, some of them may have been very handy golfers, but we're not talking top 10 in the world, right?
Some caddies have played pro golf and some can't break 100.
Okay, but are any of them have been elite players?
Yeah, Gareth's good. Gareth Lord. Who's cutting now for Justin Rose and Henrik. He's a good player, really good player. Scratch. Billy Foster, who caddied for Seve and Tiger and Lee Westwood, also was an ex-assistant professional, as I understand it. So, yeah, he can swing a club as well. Don't worry about that.
But when the elite guys are being caddied by someone who may be an excellent caddy but isn't necessarily a superb golfer... where does the ego come into that? Because something we hear a lot in football is with coaches who haven't played at the top level. They say, well, how are they going to manage the stars? How is Maurizio Sarri, the former banker, going to handle the ego of Cristiano Ronaldo? Is that a thing with caddies?
Well, I think, you know, it's different in football because you get to a point where you have to retire in football. You know, you're mentally good, but physically you can't play anymore. In golf, we have the seniors tour, which enables players to play beyond their 50th, 60th, and sometimes 70th birthday. So we don't have a lot of ex-players turned caddies. I think it helps to be a good player because it gives you a greater understanding of the game, but it's definitely not integral. And I think that no matter what, the caddies are never good as good as the players. So ultimately, the player rules the roost on that front. But I think no matter what, irrelevant of standard, I think they have to have a very good experience and understanding of the game.
And the caddy must have no ego. I thought you were going to kind of go
so
there.
So the caddy has to just shut up?
Well, not shut up, but just have no ego. That's a different thing, I think.
When you say no ego, what are we talking about?
Well, it's not about them. They're a waiter. Okay. The job is to get the player to play brilliantly. That's the game. So you have to be completely, not subservient, but you have to be completely focused on somebody else. And I think for some people that's not an easy thing.
Mm. But if the check was big enough at the end of it, they might be persuaded. Fascinating. So a caddy got to manage the shots themselves, but also the character and emotion of the player. Fairly basic stuff as well, making sure there's the right amount of clubs in the bag, making sure there are enough golf balls as well. Don't go anywhere.
This is Love Sport.
Straight down the middle here on Love Sport Radio, and we've been talking in part silly mistakes tonight in golf. Silly mistakes like having too many golf clubs in your bag or not enough golf balls, Tom Reed.
I know. Poor Clement Barrado. He's playing in the Andalusia Costa del Sol match play. And it's the stroke play element to get them to the qualification for the match play. And the 32-year-old begins with a quadruple bogey 9 on the first hole.
Ooh, done that.
Have you?
Oh, yeah.
On the first hole?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, cracking.
Unfortunately for him, he wasn't able to turn it round, picking up more bogeys on the 6th and the 8th. Turning in 41, he then double bogeyed the 10th, dropped further shots at 14 and 15, and then on 16 he hits one in the trees and realises it's the last golf ball in his bag. Unfortunately for him, he cannot finish the round, so automatically he is DQ'd from the tournament.
Right, explain this to me. Is there a limit to the amount of golf balls you're allowed to have in your bag?
There is not, Johnny. I mean, right. Going back to the caddy scenario, they may want to limit them due to weight. But,
right.
I mean, looking at his scorecard, I'm guessing he's lost half a dozen golf balls. Personally, not feeling too confident nowadays, I carry a good dozen with me.
You've got a duffel bag.
I think from now on, that caddy's probably going to have the heaviest bag on the tour. I think he's actually going to start overloading with a couple of dozen balls in there so that never happens again. So I do hope he's a very talented player, and I do hope that this won't be what he's known for, and he comes back and wins some tournaments. But yeah, that's an absolute shocker.
I've never heard of that actually happening. There are a couple of instances that spring to mind, which when it nearly happened. One of the greatest ever golfing performances was Tiger Woods' win at Pebble Beach in 2000 when he won by 15. What's not so widely known about that win is in round two, he hit a ball on the 18th into the ocean and needed to get another ball out. And Steve Williams reached into the bag and realised that there was just one left and there was still 500 yards to go, all the way down the par 5 18th at Pebble, which, if anybody's ever seen it, we could have seen it at the US Open the other week, has water all the way down the left again. So one false move, and one of the greatest performances that golf has ever seen would have been eradicated, because he had a special ball that was made by Nike, and no other player would have been able to help him out by lending him a ball, even if that's, I don't even know whether that's in the rules. So that was probably quite a little, quite a bit of a dangerous moment for
That's
Steve.
Pressure as well.
But you see, I don't think Tiger knew.
Oh, so as a caddy, you don't tell him because you don't want to change his game.
Well, you wouldn't have. I don't exactly know what the story is, but I would imagine Steve would have gone, right, well, I might just keep that to myself.
But it and can then, go both ways, right? Because if you don't tell him and he tries something really audacious and then he turns to you and goes, right, let's have another golf ball. And you go, you're looking a bit silly.
Yeah, I know. And it happened to a friend of mine, Michael Unsworth. I'm going to name him. We were assistants together and we were playing in a tournament in Holland. And actually, my wife was caddying for him. And he got to the 18th and realised...
So you had a plant, is what you're saying.
Well, otherwise I wouldn't have known about the story. But anyway, they got to the last and there was water at the front of this par four and it was a kind of a 7-iron. So he hit a 5 to the back of the green and got through it. But they were wondering what to write on the scorecard. And normally you'd write NR, which is no return. And they thought maybe ROOB would be better. Runner out of balls.
There's another story as well of 2011 Texas Open. Kevin Na is 1 under par through his first 8 holes and then takes 16 shots to complete the par 4 ninth. 16 shots, which is a record.
What was going on?
He hit one deep into the forest and continued to swipe at it until it came out. There were some air shots. There was,
Is an air stroke shot a stroke?
It is. The definition of a shot is the forward motion of the club with the intention to strike the ball. So if you think you're trying to hit it, well, only you will know, but obviously it's pretty obvious. So interestingly, a Happy Gilmore shot where you have a run at it, that's actually a legal shot.
Oh, dear.
Indeed. What was more impressive was that he made a good putt on the last hole to break 80 for a 79. So he's made a 16,
with a 16.
And still broken 80.
Hats off. Class. That's very good.
All he can do is laugh about it at that stage. But yeah, that sets the record for the highest amount of shots to complete a hole in professional golf.
That is quite something. I had never conceived of the idea of running out of golf balls. I think that would be an interesting sort of stress dynamic to add into every sport, where if you're spectacularly inaccurate as a side in football, eventually the ball boys just go, no, not getting it back. It just finishes now, lads, whatever the score is. Are there other things in golf that go wrong in very, very embarrassing ways?
This has actually been quite a week for things going wrong. For example, in the senior tour at Trevose this weekend, they had the European Legends, and playing in that tournament were 99 Open champion Paul Laurie and Carl Mason, who is one of the most successful senior golfers to ever play the game, and a member at Tadmarten Heath, which is just down the road from me, actually, and a great little heathland course. Anyway, these guys, they playing the same ball in terms of brand, and they also had the same number on it, and also a similar marking. Now, non-golfers might wonder why on earth there would be a number on the ball. Well, that's actually for identification purposes. Nothing more, doesn't mean anything. But the pros sometimes, again, play the same brand, so they have a little dot or a little line or a little marking that they put on their ball so that they know that that ball is theirs. Anyway, these two balls were over the hill and they came to them and they didn't really check particularly, and they played their shots and they finished the hole. And then they played another hole, the sixth, and then by the time they got to the seventh, one of them realised, actually, they were playing with the other one's ball. And they must have swapped at the fifth. And by then, it was too late to go back and change it. Because if you play a wrong ball and you notice immediately, it's a two-shot penalty. If you finish the hole, or if you continue play, you're disqualified. So they've been red carded by playing the wrong ball. So that's one.
Why did neither of them notice? How does that
well,
happen?
Well, they had the same number, the same brand, and a similar marking as the report goes. And it's a very easy mistake to make. I've done it actually in a pre-qualification in Holland, and went into a bush. It was Titleist on it, and I think it was the same number. I thought, oh, that's obviously it. Got out, chipped it out. And then got to the fairway and realised, oh no, that's not my ball. Missed the pre-qualification by one. Lovely.
Is that a scenario where you would be within your rights to blame your caddy?
No. That's no, because you're the one. You've hit it. You've identified it. It can be, I suppose, part of the caddy's job to do that. But I would say that falls fairly and squarely on the player. It wasn't the only weirdness of the week. There was some hitting of trees, and that can be tricky as well. Matthias Schwab at the BMW in Germany, Austrian player, and he was hit it in the trees on the last round and had a practice swing, caught a branch, and thankfully didn't break it. Now, if you break a branch with your practice swing, that is a two-shot penalty because that can improve the space that you have to swing behind your backswing. And luckily for him, and there was a rules official right by, and the commentators went, right, well, that I hope he hasn't broken that, and there was no infringement, so that was kind of okay. But you've really got to be careful, and I've done this as well. I've broken a branch with a practice swing, and my player, the player that I was playing with, said, oh, what happens there? And the other guy went, he knows. And so it was a two-shot penalty. And there was another, the winner, Andrea Pavan, Italy, he had the same problem, not quite with the same tree, but not far off on the 15th. He had to make a backswing, and he caught the tree in the backswing. And so you got this branch swallowing up the club at the top of your backswing. And it was not insignificant. And you could hear the rustle, and he carried on with the shot. And luckily for him, or skillfully for him, he actually hit the ball onto the front edge of the green, chipped it up, held the putt, made a par. And this actually happened to me, and I missed the ball once in a competition before I turned pro in a club medal. Caught it in the branch, missed the ball, and then I had a really quick swing afterwards and hit the ball, scuffed it up the fairway to about 100 yards from the hole, and then hold a wedge for a par. It was one of the weirdest pars I've ever made. But it just shows you that there are weird things waiting for you on a golf course, and you never know when they're coming.
You've got to be vigilant. Coming up, a cheerier story. We've heard of struggles, we've heard of pain, we've heard of difficulty. Now for a bit of poetry.
This is Love Sport.
In golf and all sport, various players have pre-match rituals. You might put one shoe on before the other, you might polish a certain kind of club, or you might read yourself poetry written by a child, which has been the case in one player's week, Hannah Green.
Yeah, Hannah met a young girl, Lily Costner, at the Anna Inspiration Tournament, which is the ladies' first major. Anna was... Lily was so pleased to have got a signed ball, and that she wrote a poem for Hannah, and she gave it to her on the eighth green, and during the last round of the tournament. And we can't actually find out what it said, but Hannah says in her interview afterwards that actually it was a lovely thing to distract her away from the pressures, and she read it and it inspired her, and she won the tournament. It was looking a lot easier than it turned out. She had to make a sand save at the last hole, hold an 8-foot putt for an even par 72 for a 9-under total. And standing in the fairway, she had a 2-shot lead. And Park Sung Hin made a birdie. So suddenly she had to par the last, pulled it into a bunker, but managed to get it up and down. And this is a bit of a surprise, actually. It's her first major. She was, prior to that, 114th in the world, and she's the first Australian since Carrie Webb in 2001 to win a ladies major champion. And she's only 22. We'll be hearing a lot more from her, I would imagine.
And interestingly, on Carrie Webb as well, I mean, she's obviously acted as a role model for Hannah, because they stayed in the same house this week. They kind of had an Aussie theme to their house, where she was feeling a lot of pressure on Saturday, holding the lead going into a major championship, which she's never done before. She's 22 years old, and she has Carrie Webb there. And I think what was interesting as well was that I think Carrie gave her like a calming influence, essentially. And it was interesting, you know, Carrie sort of talking about her after the win, is that, you know, Hannah picked up 3 wins on the Symetra Tour, which is the official developmental tour of the LPGA. And even though it's on a completely different level to the LPGA, and especially a major championship, she was used to winning. She's hit great shots under pressure to win golf tournaments. And she definitely drew on that experience coming down the final stretch, because, as Jeremy said, you know, all of a sudden her lead is cut from 2-1 on 18. She puts the ball in the bunker, and you think it's got player front all over it, but she hits the bunker shot out to 8 foot and knocks the putt in. It was a really impressive finish, and completely agree with Jeremy. I think she's going to win a lot of tournaments. First major at 22 is an amazing start to her career.
Well, maybe there is a lyrical secret to her success. She said after her win, "I had the poem in the back of my yardage book because I didn't want it to get rained on. I didn't want it to get ruined. A couple of times on the back nine when I was feeling nervous and had some time," she's actually rhyming herself, she's clearly taken that poetry on, "I actually read it to myself. I have to thank Lily for writing that. I think it really helped me." Now, we've talked about caddies a lot on this show and how knowing a course is really important. Could we see players now try and recruit assistants who are experts in iambic pentameter?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but
only a Cambridge graduate in English could ask that question.
You're going to need a translation there. Yeah. No, I think that guys and girls definitely have something, you know, some sort of keepsake with them. some lucky ball marker, some lucky way, some lucky hat, maybe just something that they keep on their person that they believe, you know, gives them luck in tournaments. And definitely, you know, having that poem that meant something to her, keeping that in her yardage book, I think stuff like that for her just kept her calm and gave her a bit of a comfort blanket in a scenario that she's not familiar with.
There are lots of superstitions in golf. I mean, I know Tony Jacklin had one red tee and four white tees in his pocket every time. And why? Who knows? But he just did. And people get into habits. They put one shoe on before the other. Or like, and footballers have this as well, sort of superstitions and routines and rituals that they go through that puts them in their, to borrow a phrase from the greatest golfing movie ever made, puts them in their happy place.
Which is?
Happy Gilmore, of course.
Happy Gilmore, ooh,
obviously.
See, I'm not sure.
Obviously, not
sure. Big Tin Cup fan over here.
Well, that's good too. I mean, they're the best too. You'll get no argument, but Happy's the best.
I know you're keen to argue about golf courses as well. Have we got any particularly special ones coming up?
Well, I think the course at Hazeltine was soft. They've had a lot of rain in the Midwest, and it's Minnesota, so it's been a really wet season. But even so, it's one of those courses where I find it hard to get excited about the golf course. And as you will know by now, we've done three shows, I'm a big fan of firm running conditions. I thought the setup for the US Ladies Open was far better at the Charleston Country Club. Fast running fairways, not too much savage rough like the USGA usually serve up to the men. And this was the same. It's a Robert Trent Jones golf course, and it's one of those typical American courses. Soft, shallow bunkers, everything big, and big rough as well. And Tony, and again, Jacklin won the Open, and it's been redesigned since then. Dave Hill, who was an American competitor, said all this course is missing is a couple of hundred cows. And he got a big fine for it. So they've had To be fair, they've had a big redesign since then. But it provided a great tournament. And what's never in doubt is that the players provide great entertainment. It's just that sometimes I get a little bit fed up with the standard American-style golf course. People come from all over the world to play the great links courses and heathland courses of the British Isles and other countries as well. And the reason they do that is because they are interesting courses with firm running conditions and no rough, and the game is completely different. And then it seems like nobody's taking any notice. Then you go back and you get these standard damp American parkland courses with bunkers that aren't greenside. They're actually in the rough. Fairway bunkers that aren't actually in the fairway. They're, you know, with these collars of rough all around them, so the ball doesn't run into them. And the game is played much more through the air rather than on the ground. The game's simply more interesting when the ball does something when it lands. And there was a bit the same at TPC River Highlands, although there were some runoff areas around the greens. In notably, actually, when Keegan Bradley made a double bogey at the 17th, he ran quite a long way through, and there was no thick rough to stop the ball, and it ran down a slope, and he had a really difficult chip, and he ended up taking four to get down from that point, which just goes to show you just don't need all this thick rough. And so soft conditions are, I think they're just an inferior stage, and both the courses, both at the LPGA and at the Travelers Tournament, were that kind of slightly dull parkland American style course.
And I think, you know, going back to Hazeltine, 2016 Ryder Cup, when Davis Love was captain, he had some bombers on that team, and they widened out the fairways, got rid of the rough, they softened up the golf course, and Europe got a hammering from 17 points to 11, the 6-point victory from the US. And it was another example of, you know, our captain will tighten up the golf course and make it intricate and tricky, whereas the American captain will do the opposite. They'll try and widen out the golf course because it favours the American players, and further confirms Jeremy's point there. But, you know, I think Pebble Beach was just a wonderful example of a golf course that it has stood the test of time and still challenges players in the biggest tournaments in golf. And it's a bit frustrating sometimes to watch golf on TV on golf courses that are uninteresting, and really the only challenge is having thick rough grown up around the greens.
Just on the Ryder Cup, going back to Thomas Bjorn, and one thing I didn't know until this week, actually, was that they have this thing about mowing the fairways with the grain so that the ball either runs more or stops. At the Masters, they're trying to play the course, make the course play slightly longer, so they mow the grass into the players as they drive, so it doesn't run so far. And on the On the tournament, on the first day of the Ryder Cup, they mowed it with the grain, so the ball was going in the same direction as the grain, so it ran more, and there was water at the end of the runoff, and the Americans didn't realise, and so there was one sneaky little trick that Thomas Bjorn used, and in the practice round, the rough had been mowed into the player.
Well, it sounds to me like it's another kind of trick that caddies need to be aware of, and that is why they're so important. It's been a wonderful show. Join us next week on Straight Down the Middle.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.